everything is amazing right now, and nobody's happy. Like, in my lifetime, the changes in the world have been incredible. When I was a kid, we had a rotary phone. We had a phone that you had to stand next to, and you had to dial it.
Yes.
You don't realize how primitive. You're making sparks in a phone, and you actually would hate people with zeros in their numbers because it was more. I'm like, oh, this guy's got two zeros. Screw that guy. Why do I want to? Yeah.
Do you feel that we now, in the 21st century, we take technology for granted?
Well, yeah, because now we live in an amazing, amazing world, and it's wasted on the crappiest generation of just spoiled idiots that don't care, because this is what people are like now. They got their phone, and they're like, it won't. Give it a second. It's going to space. Can you give it a second to get back from space? Is the speed of light too slow for you? Yeah. I was on an airplane, and there was internet, high-speed internet on the airplane. That's
yes.
The newest thing that I know exists. And I'm sitting on the plane, and they go, open up your laptop, you can go on the internet. And it's fast, and I'm watching YouTube clips. I'm in an airplane. And then it breaks down, and they apologize, the internet's not working. The guy next to me goes, this is bullshit. Like, how quickly the world owes him something.
Yes.
He knew existed only 10 seconds ago.
Right. Right.
And on planes. Flying is the worst one because people come back from flights and they tell you their story. And it's like a horror story. It's they act like their flight was like a cattle car in the 40s in Germany. That's how bad they make it sound.
Right.
They're like, it was the worst day of my life. First of all, we didn't board for 20 minutes. And then we get on the plane, and they made us sit there on the runway for 40 minutes. We had to sit there. Oh, really? What happened next? Did you fly through the air incredibly like a bird? Did you partake in the miracle of human flight, you non-contributing zero, that you got to fly? You're flying! You're sitting in a chair in the sky.
Yes. Yeah.
But it doesn't go back a lot.
Hey, everybody, this is Brett, and welcome back to School Sucks Podcast. Today's February 2nd, 2012, and you're going to have to excuse the sound of my voice. I'm feeling a little bit under the weather. Actually, I'm feeling a lot under the weather today. Sick as a clam, I think, is the old saying. Anyway, today on the podcast, Sidney Rock, he's the host of a show called Gaming and Liberty. And when I first heard about this podcast, I was excited. I think this is something that nobody else is doing. And I looked through his list of shows, and he covers a wide variety of topics. On our show today, we are going to cover a wide variety of topics. Everything from, boy, SOPA to propaganda, pro-military propaganda in video games, the potential learning value of video games versus school, and intrinsic versus extrinsic motivation. So the show runs about an hour. We cover a lot of stuff, and I'll get right to it. Another thing, we are doing a live show tonight, Gardner Goldsmith and myself. The second Liberty Conspiracy School Sucks live show will be tonight. So if you happen to hear this, you can tune in at 10 p.m. Eastern time tonight on the Liberty Radio Network to hear that. Call in. We'll talk. Looking forward to that. So anyway, that's it. Hope you're having a good week. Stay warm and have some soup. That's what people said to me. Okay, bye. My guest today is Sidney Rock, and he is the host of Gaming and Liberty. How you doing, Sidney?
Hi, Brett. I'm doing great. How are you?
Doing good. And you're up in Canada, right? But same time zone?
Yeah, I'm in Montreal.
Oh.
Born and raised.
Really? So you're probably having some snow there as well?
Yeah, it's funny, though, because we had a few days of extreme cold. And then for the last, I'd say, 72 hours, it's been very mild by winter standards. I can actually see asphalt on the streets, just to give you an idea of how much it's warmed up. So I'm expecting Mother Nature to freeze up again and and start going in her peaks and valleys anytime soon.
Well, I think that that's a... I know it gets cold there in the winter. I think I've only ever been there in the summer. It's a beautiful city.
Oh, yeah.
Is that Olympic Stadium still standing? Has that been demolished?
It is.
You're kidding me.
Yeah. That's... man.
Have you ever been in there?
I have for a baseball game, which tells you how long it's been, because I think the Montreal Expos moved out of Montreal several years ago.
Isn't it just the grossest place?
Oh, yeah, and it's out of the way. Like, a joke that I like to tell people is that everything is far from the Olympic Stadium.
It's interesting.
Yeah.
It's a very interesting building if people don't know what we're talking about. It was built in the mid-1970s for the 76 Olympics were there. And it's, you know, your typical round, perfectly symmetrical stadium, but it has this sort of leaning tower that extends over it. And this canopy or this canvas tarp comes down and covers the opening in the stadium. I think in the early 80s, the apparatus that raised and lowered the canvas thing rusted shut. So now it's just permanently shut, like sort of trapping all of the grossness in this gross yellow 70s stadium where the Montreal – I was there. Now, I mean, I've been to a lot of baseball games in Boston, and that, you know, it's always a full 35,000 people there. I went to an Expos game, I think probably in the early 90s. There could not have been more than 2,000 people in this 75,000-seat stadium. And people in Fenway Park in Boston, like, fight for foul balls and chase foul balls. And these people, I don't know if they just didn't care about baseball. I mean, if your team is the Expos, I don't know how exciting it could be because they were never really good. But they would just watch these foul balls bounce around in empty seats, and no one would even go get them. It was very interesting. But it is – go ahead.
I don't follow baseball much, but I can imagine that. I know that the last couple times the stadium has been used was when the Montreal Alouettes were in the playoffs, which is Canadian football.
I'm surprised they still use that for anything, but it is an interesting building that is actually an interesting complex. Oh, well, so let's talk about Gaming and Liberty. I was very excited to hear about this podcast a month ago. Can you give us a synopsis, like when you started it and, you know, what the goals are, what you're trying to do?
Well, basically, I started in March of last year, so it hasn't been a year yet. And ultimately, I'd been into the whole libertarian philosophical thing for about a year prior to that. And I kept being annoyed by how whenever I would hear video games mentioned, it would be either how World of Warcraft is keeping us in a trance state and how Call of Duty is desensitizing us to violence. And eventually I listened to an episode of the Corbett Report in which he played a clip from a very controversial speech by Jesse Schell. Basically depicting this kind of dystopian future where everything is monitored and you're getting points for brushing your teeth and all that stuff. And I had been aware of that speech basically the week after it happened. And when I heard that speech, I was like, okay, someone's got to speak up. It's about time someone started talking about games and how they could be used for something more than that. So basically, I explore how games can be used as a means to spread the ideas of liberty. And when I say games, I'm not talking specifically about video games. As a matter of fact, I have an affinity towards board games, which I feel offer an advantage that video games can't quite harness yet, because voice chat and text chat is cool and all, but actual physical presence in the same place is very hard to emulate in video games. So that's basically what I do in the show.
So what would be some examples of, like, real life player-to-player board games that you're into?
I don't play as many board games as I would like. I would say that the last couple board games that I really got into are the really popular ones like Settlers of Catan and Carcassonne and that kind of thing. I also enjoy military war games like Risk and Axis and Allies. Well, maybe less Risk. I think Risk is very rudimentary as far as war games is concerned. But as a matter of fact, I often call Risk Yahtzee with a map. But basically, I like those kinds of things. But the thing with war games is it's very long to explain to someone who hasn't played it before. So that's why it's the last times I've played board games, it's been more into the really popular ones that are pretty easy to explain, like Settlers, and also Munchkin, which is a card game that simulates like Dungeons and Dragons games, but in a context where all the players are like maxing out their characters and going for really over the top stuff.
I'll tell you what, though, I don't know what kind of a sci-fi fan you are. I assume you're somewhat familiar with the genre, but here in New Hampshire, we've been getting real into a game called Battlestar Galactica. And that is definitely based on the television show. And it is probably – now, I'm not an expert. I'm fine with Scrabble. But as far as some of these more complex games are concerned, but this is pretty intricate. And I think that this is a game that would be very difficult to play online because a lot of the gameplay is about reading the people you're playing with, because there's a lot of intrigue, like who are the humans, who are the Cylons. And I've really enjoyed that. What I'd be interested in knowing, before we talk maybe more specifically about video games, as far as these games that you're into, what are the lessons for young people related to liberty that you've found in this area?
That is a really difficult question for me to answer because and I run into this whenever I explain the concept of what I want to do with the show. It's that I don't think that there are any real examples of games that teach these lessons in a way that satisfies me. There are some games that come close and lean towards that direction, and I've done a few case studies on my show, but they're more video games. In fact, most of them are Flash web browser-based games. And I know La Mole Industria, which is an Italian company, has a few games where basically their strategy is to put you in the position of the people that that they want to denounce. A nice example that I liked was Oiligarchy, where you basically play big oil interests. And you drill in like Texas and South America and Africa, and every couple of years there's an election, and you basically give money to both parties, and the idea is no matter who wins the election, if you gave campaign contributions strategically, you're going to have people who are favorable to big oil interests in Congress, and that will help you to expand your oil drilling capabilities. And as a matter of fact, in that game, there's Iraq is a place where you can drill, but you can't drill there at first. And what happens is, I forget exactly under what context, but ultimately, and I have no idea where they got this, but you stage a war and you use that as an excuse to drill in Iraq. And that's how you go about unlocking Iraq as an oil field to drill into. So I think that Mole Industria stuff is comes very close to the kinds of things that I would like to see happen. And there's also a website called gamesforchange.org, I believe, which has it has an arcade, which has a lot of different games of varying levels of fun, to be quite honest, but they attack a lot of relevant issues from a lot of different angles, and I think those are interesting as well. Like a game that I played that I found cool was Race for the White House, where you basically simulate a presidential campaign. So you pick your issues and you pick a running mate, and then it's all about raising money and then doing public appearances and commercials. And when you do that, you get the electoral votes, and then after like 10 weeks, the election happens, and then you either win or you don't. And I think that there were some really interesting things that you get to explore while doing that. For instance, for me, at first when I was playing that game, it's all about setting up your financial engine where you can get money and be able to do the commercials and that kind of thing. And another thing that I found interesting was, because you pick your issues, right? And your opponent also has issues. And in my particular game that I played, California, because each state has issues, and California, which is a really influential state, did not have any issues that I supported. But it did oppose one issue that my opponent supported. So basically, whenever I would speak or run a commercial in California, I could only do hit jobs saying, my opponent supports this, blah, 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 vote for me. So I found that was a very interesting situation that I was in.
I wish I had known about such a game, because I remember doing this simulation, what you were just talking about. It reminded me of this experience. I was working with a student who goes to an online charter school. I was tutoring him, and he had to take a government class, and the teacher was, you know, very standard treatment of U.S. government and civics. And there was the simulation of a presidential campaign, and I just said to him, boy, I wish somebody could make something even remotely realistic, because this is not that.
Yeah.
So, yeah, that's when you talk about, you know, being kind of difficult to produce examples of liberty-themed games, do you apply that maybe not so much to board games but to online or just video games in general as well? Do you find that it's hard to find these games anywhere?
I would think so. And honestly, I don't think there's anything wrong with that, in the sense that, like, not every movie is a documentary. Mm-hmm. And I don't see anything wrong with having a game, digital or board game, that has with its only goal to just have fun and forget about your worries for a couple minutes or hours or whatever. But it's, and especially with like big budget AAA video games, you kind of want to have a level of success to justify the huge investment that you have to make just to produce the game from beginning to end. So I can see how, let's say, a game that teaches, I don't know, peaceful parenting, for instance, which is a really important issue in the liberty movement. I don't know that such a game would be popular enough to justify the investment of making a big budget AAA video game.
Sure.
So I can kind of understand.
Well, the reason why I ask is because from what I've seen, and I don't play that many video games, but from what I've seen really through advertisements on television, it seems like the message of more realistic games, like non-fantasy games, like I guess Call of Duty would be the best example. You mentioned this at the beginning of the show, desensitizing young people to that kind of violence, or making that kind of violence look heroic or gratifying. So it seems like a majority of the market would be going the other way. Is that accurate?
As far as away from libertarianism?
Yeah.
Oh, yeah. Well, I think it's funny, because I plan on talking about Call of Duty in a future episode. I hope to get around it soon. But I think that, and this actually plays off to something that I heard in your show, because I know that you mentioned how when a movie producer wants to use a tank in a movie, the military will go, sure, we'll let you use your tank, just let us take a look at the script.
Right.
And then they make sure that the movie advances a message that they find satisfactory.
Yeah.
So
an example of that was the Transformers movies.
Yes. I only saw the first one, but I can totally get how I think there are three in all now. I can totally get how all three of them would provide similar messages. And the thing is, I don't see, and I have no way of confirming this, but I don't see why it would be that different for video games, where you want a likeness of a tank, and I'm sure with all the intellectual property BS that you kind of need the military's approval to have the likeness of a tank in your game. So I don't see what would stop them from saying, sure, we'll let you use the likeness of our tank, just let us look at the script of your single player campaign. And like, it's not that big of a stretch compared to what happens in movies. So I can't confirm or deny, but it seems like a logical step when you consider what happens in movies.
So you devoted a whole show, I mean, since we're kind of moving this way, and you mentioned IP, and we will get to that eventually. There's another thing I wanted to talk about. But You devoted a whole show to propaganda in video games. So what were your findings?
Basically, it was first of all, I wanted to demystify the word propaganda because I think that it's one of those words that's really loaded. And when basically I read Edward Bernays' book, Propaganda, and one of the things I realized is that as creepy as some of the things in the book are, the definition that he proposes seems to apply to anything that you do when you want to advance an opinion or a position to as wide of an audience as possible using as many means as you can.
Sure.
When you do that, you're engaged in propaganda. And as much as there can be propaganda that teaches us to be afraid of Muslim people, there can be propaganda that encourages you to eat right and exercise.
Yep.
And even though I think that there's a lot of propaganda in the that would hinder our liberty, so to speak. But it's important to know that no matter what message it is that you're broadcasting, if you're doing it in a way that you want to reach as many people as possible, using as many means as possible, according to the dictionary, you're engaging in propaganda. So as soon as I as soon as I got over that part, I looked at how it's being used in the United States, mainly in military recruitment. This is something that I've been aware of for a while, and it talks about how basically a lot of there are some like military recruitment centers that have these interactive video game simulations where you're taking a you're going on a mission. Like one of them has this Hummer with like this screen surrounding the Hummer, and the children are like going in there and shooting like fake guns at fake terrorists on the screen, and you get a score, and then surprise, surprise, if you get a high score, a military recruiter will walk up to you and say, hey, you did pretty well in that game.
Wow.
Have you ever thought of doing that in real life? That kind of thing. And that's like one of the more blatant cases. But apparently the military also does things like sponsoring Call of Duty tournaments and paintball and stuff like that. So basically how they're using games to recruit personnel. And, of course, this is without mentioning the most blatant example of this, which is America's Army, which is basically a recruiting game. I mean, I don't think it exists for any other purpose than to provide a quote realistic impression of a military life. And I watched a video of that, and like there's a training camp section. I know that it was basically produced and developed with the intention of getting people to think joining the military is cool.
Yeah, and it would seem like that would be a wise place to direct energy and resources as far as propaganda campaigns are concerned, since there's so much energy and resources from young people going into this area. You know what I mean?
Right, right. And I mean, even for me, like, honestly, I love first-person shooters, and I'm not a very good shot, but one of the things that I enjoy is the tactics and strategies that I can use to kind of compensate for the fact that I can't aim very well, like flanking someone or proper grenade use and those kinds of things, which can like even the score. And that's something I enjoy.
Oh, so that actually brings me to another question. How about, if I could just ask you to maybe speak generally on the educational value of video games. I think a lot of people still see this as a distraction, a waste of time, something that is even in some cases detrimental. Do you feel like there is a real educational value to gaming?
I actually did an episode devoted entirely to that. I think that all games teach, whether it's a video game or a board game or any game, even sports. The thing is, a game at the very least will teach you the skills that you need to become good at the game. And that depending on the game, can have value. I mean, even a game as asinine as tic-tac-toe will teach you something. Like, in that case, it's a really bad example because tic-tac-toe is basically a broken game.
I did a whole unit with a group of elementary school kids. It's funny that you mentioned that, using tic-tac-toe. And I called
really?
It was about innovative ways of thinking and how sometimes the things that so often lead to dead ends, or the obstacles that seem to lead to dead ends in problem solving, are about really sometimes stupid rules that are just in the way, that really don't make sense anymore and aren't relevant. And if you break those rules, you find you might have a fast track to a solution. So we looked at tic-tac-toe, a broken game, as you say, that no one ever wins. And we started saying, well, what if this wasn't a rule? What if you could go two times in a row? What if so just by breaking the basic rules of tic-tac-toe, we wound up coming up with these very exciting games based on this totally pointless and unexciting game. It's funny that you mentioned that, but you're right. It would be more of a challenge to get a meaningful lesson out of tic-tac-toe playing by the rules of tic-tac-toe.
Right.
But go ahead.
Exactly. And I mean, and this is something that I hope to be able to integrate into my show eventually, but I think that the life lessons that you learn playing poker can have value in your everyday life, just be it estimating risk and also interpersonal skills like being able to detect deception, being able to deceive effectively, although that arguably isn't the best skill to become good at. But I think that the things that you learn in being able to deceive effectively can also be used to detect when someone is trying to deceive you.
Right.
Yeah,
absolutely.
It's all about what the rules of the game are, and choice of theme is also important, because if you take a game like Call of Duty, the theme is military life, you know. But if you take the basic mechanic, which is aiming a weapon from the first person and shooting, you can use that. I don't know. Like a lighthouse game where you're aiming the light of the lighthouse to guide ships away from a rock or whatever. I mean, I'm brainstorming on the fly here, but the basic mechanic of aiming something from the first person and clicking could be used for basically anything. And that's where the importance of theme comes in. And that can influence the lessons that you can learn as you become good in a game.
Right. So I often wonder, too, because like I feel that there's so many authority figures in young people's lives today that are saying that's a waste of time. And what's really important is that you know, not just the 35 hours a week that you're in school, but also the 2 or 3 hours a night after that you do the requisite enhancement, or enhancement and enrichment are not the right words for homework. the additional work that's piled on is like, that's what is education, and what you're doing is wasting time. Have you ever thought about ways of like maybe counseling young people a little bit as far as how they can sell gaming to teachers, parents, those kinds of authorities as educational tools?
I honestly never thought of it in that context, because honestly, one thing that the action type games undeniably train you in is hand-eye coordination.
Mm-hmm.
But even that, as a selling point to an adult who may or may not play games, I don't think that yes, but I'm getting better hand-eye coordination would be a very effective argument to convince someone that you shouldn't be doing your English lesson or your math homework or whatever.
Anything that's intrinsically motivated, that's new, I think offers an opportunity to have, you know, like the neural pathways moving in a new way, or to have a new challenge on thinking processes that wasn't there before.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, it's the that little aha moment where you discover a new way to exercise your skills within the bounds of a game that can provide great pleasure. And not only that, if the game has, how can I say, if the game trains you in something that can be useful outside of the game, it can have real value as well. I mean, a simple example from a game that I've never played, for the record, and I actually slammed World of Warcraft a couple times in the first few episodes that I did, and a good friend of mine mentioned that the auction house that you have in World of Warcraft taught him about offer and demand and markets, marketplaces and economics. And that is something that I never would have been privy to unless I had played World of Warcraft. And it's an example of the kinds of little things that can help you out in real life that you may never think of if you never actually played yourself.
Right. And I just think, I know this is something that you covered. You did a whole episode about intrinsic versus extrinsic rewards. And I think that the real general value in all of these things, regardless of how incredibly useful or minimally useful they are, the potential learner has an internal desire to pursue these things. And that makes it, I think, a more concrete and more valuable learning experience, even if it's a minor one. So I've never had that kind of counseling with young people either, where somebody came to me and said, gosh, you know, my parents just don't let me play enough video games, and can you help me sell this to them as a you know, an educational activity? But right. I think that the most important thing, and this obviously applies to all kinds of gamings and a variety of other activities, is that if it's intrinsically motivated, it has far greater potential as a learning experience than something, you know, on the other hand, like school, that's imposed. Mm-hmm. And it's just like,
yes,
all you're learning there is basically pain management.
Right, right. And I think that's something that games that are really games have to offer that's really unique, because the whole intrinsic versus extrinsic motivation was a challenge to me at first before I read Alfie Kohn's book Punished by Rewards, in the sense that a game in itself, when you're playing it, the only thing that the game has to offer you is points and maybe a spot on the leaderboard, and basically all these extrinsic things, even the pleasure of winning the game, that kind of thing, it's all extrinsic. However, this is offset by the fact that when you're playing a game by definition is something you do voluntarily. If you don't have the option to stop, it's not a game, it's something else.
Right.
And yeah. And the thing is, the fact that a game is something that you engage in voluntarily and you have control over what you do and who you do it with is something that can lead the motivation more intrinsically, where you're doing it of your own free will in a way that you have a lot more control over within the bounds of the game, because games have rules and all that stuff. And that's also part of what makes a game a game. But I think that the whole points thing is secondary to the fact that you're engaging in this activity and training the skills that you need to master the game in a way that's completely free and that you don't have to do if you didn't want to, and that you can even stop in the middle of it if you wanted to.
Sure, and I think it might be too, when you're talking about game, I mean, there's no prize patrol really that comes to your house for almost any game that you play with a big Publisher's Clearinghouse style check. You know, I'm sure there are competitions where there's prizes and all of that, but most of, like, I'm not that much of a gamer. The last game that I played, and this was not in the 80s, this was like last week, was Legends of Zelda. I found an emulator flash player on a website.
Wow.
And I wanted to, I was working with this kid.
The original Nintendo version? The NES
version of the game. And I worked with this homeschool student who's about 9. And I said, here's an adventure that I bet he'd really get into. So I'm playing it, and I'm kind of showing it. Like, you get a wooden sword, and then you go and you stab these guys, and you get some coins, and then you get some coins, and we can buy some stuff. And after about 20 minutes, he's like, no, I'm not interested. And I wound up just leaving that tab open, bringing it home, and playing it for like 3 hours that night.
Right, right.
And, you know, I think the whole point that I was trying to make is, like, it's more maybe about the journey than the destination, because you'd go through all of this stuff and you beat Zelda, and there's like this 30-second thing at the end where he, you know, meets up with the princess and he's got the Triforce and that's it. Then it rolls credits.
Right, right.
You know, so it's anticlimactic, but I don't think that's why people are attracted to it for the ending of the game.
No, especially not considering that all those old games, the reward that you got for finishing the game was a bit of text and the credits.
Right.
And honestly, on a fundamental level, that hasn't changed much either. Although some games actually have a mini game that you play during the credits, which is really cool. But the whole. I think that the real reward is the satisfaction of knowing that you did it.
Yeah, exactly. And I think of overcoming the obstacles along the way.
Yeah, absolutely.
Zelda has these, I don't know if they're rhinoceroses or something, but they have this armor on and they're blue. Oh, they're so difficult. And there's a room of like 11 of them at one point.
Yeah.
You gotta get potions.
Honestly, as soon as you mentioned Zelda combined with 9-year-old, I wasn't surprised that he got discouraged quickly, because that game is hard.
It is a very hard game.
I never finished I never finished any Zelda game. I just realized that I never finished any Zelda game. The one that I got furthest into was A Link to the Past, which is the Super NES version.
Mm-hmm.
And after that, a friend of mine sat me down in front of the original Zelda, where I'm used to being able to sidestep in 8 directions with my sword extended and do that that circular swing thing.
Yeah.
And all of a sudden, I'm in a situation where if I want to attack an enemy, you got to do that move where you walk away from him for a moment and then back towards him to stab him. And that just couldn't it didn't compute, basically, because part of what makes a game fun is basically it all comes down to the flow state, where you're blissfully productive and you're just, you know, time seems to vanish and there's just you and whatever it is you're doing. And to get into that flow state, you need 2 things. You need the challenge to be big enough to stretch your capabilities, but, and this is the key, you have to believe that you can do it. And if the challenge is too big, you're just going to get discouraged and you lose flow and you're like, why am I doing this? And then you stop. Unless, of course, it's not really a game because you can't stop. And in that case, well, all my sympathies, you know.
Well, I think that was more, for me, I played more of those old games. Like, I haven't done the last modern game that I played, I think, was that I really enjoyed was Portal.
But
before that, I mean, you were talking the 80s, early 90s, and some of those games were so poorly made that it was like you couldn't, it would just be a matter of trying almost an infinite amount of things to try and figure out what to do to finish the game. I remember there was this game called Rygar, and this guy just ran around and like you'd go in one place and then another place, and the game didn't say, I could never figure out what I was supposed to do or the point to the game. And I think that there was a lot of that frustration when I was younger. And of course, like, what's the thing that comes with its own TV and it has the mats that go over it? This is like, we're going back to the, what was it called?
That has its own TV.
It is the unit. What is it called? Vectrex. Have you ever heard of Vectrex?
No.
Vectrex is, it's like this self-contained arcade. It was probably made in the early 80s. And all of the games are completely impossible.
Okay.
They're completely you play baseball against the computer gets a no-hitter. It's every game is impossible. Right. And they're all never ending. So I think, like, as far as what people – you can see, like, as the progression of video games over 25 or 30 years, like, people's goals, people's reasons for playing them seem to be a lot different. Now, of course, we also have to consider, like, capabilities of the games themselves as far as what they could do. But people want endings. People want achievements and collecting things.
Absolutely. And there's also the fact that the earlier games, a lot of the early games were arcade games where the goal was to get you to put as many quarters as possible into that machine. And to do that, a really hard, virtually impossible game is a good way to do that. Whereas today, where you download a game and you can have infinite lives, but you also have other games that you could be playing at the same time. If you have the option to either bang your head against the wall because to you the situation is hopeless, or play another game, it's a pretty easy decision to make.
Right, absolutely. So, to change directions.
30 years before SOPA, MPAA feared the VCR. So somebody's uncovered some testimony by Jack Valenti, the former MPAA head, the Motion Picture Association of America, and this is him speaking before the House Judiciary Subcommittee in 1982. He said to the gathered Congress people, "I say to you that the VCR is to the American film producer and the American public as the Boston Strangler is to the woman home alone."
Right, Jack Valenti arguing against technology. Of course, the VCR gave birth to the Blockbuster franchise of rentals of video, a multi-billion dollar revenue source for Hollywood, which went into the DVD market, another multi-billion source of revenue, which could enter into the download market. At every step of the way, Hollywood has put their foot down and said, no, we need protection from the government against any competition, and they have reluctantly been dragged through the innovative process to multi-billion dollar profits going forward. Why anyone listens to these idiots in Los Angeles, I don't understand. Meanwhile, in New York, you've got people like Louis C.K., who put on his concert film online, no DRM, asked for people to just give him money for the show, and he raised over $1 million. No Bob Iger, no Disney, no CAA, no management fee, just artist, public, and boku bucks.
To change directions completely here, and you've done a pretty good job on your show of covering a pretty broad range of topics, you know, from gaming addiction to intrinsic versus extrinsic motivation, propaganda in gaming. Your most recent show was about IP, or the Stop Internet Piracy Act. And I think that this is something that potentially affects all of us, and I think that it's something that could have a dramatic impact on young people in ways that they do not even understand, if they are even aware of the fact that SOPA is something that's being discussed. What was your coverage of this on your show?
Well, that's the thing. One of the challenges with what I'm doing is that it's gaming and liberty, not gaming or liberty. So there are some things that, as much as I would love to cover them, if I can't make it relevant to both those issues, it becomes more difficult for me. And the way that I managed to make it relevant to the show was to, first of all, discuss the impact of such an act on independent game developers and digital distribution, because honestly, digital distribution of games is often the only option for an independent developer, whereas, you know, Activision or EA, they don't have any problem getting shelf space in a retail store. But if a site that sells games digitally gets threatened by copyright infringement, and let's say they use American services for payment and advertising, as soon as, let's say that SOPA passed, if another game that was outside of the U.S. and sold on that site was infringing, quote-unquote, on someone's copyright, if the person made a complaint using the SOPA stuff, then PayPal and the advertisers would basically be forced to cut off services to the site to in order to not lose their immunity, because part of the things you need to have immunity is to at least cooperate with people who are claiming copyright infringement. And the thing is, if PayPal and the advertisers cut off their services to the website, that would affect every game that was sold on that website. And that becomes a threat to people who didn't even infringe on their copyright. And honestly, I don't think that intellectual property is a valid concept. I wish that I was more able to defend that position, but ultimately I think it's intuitive to understand that if I duplicate something, you still have it. So to equate that with theft is misinformed at very best and dishonest at worst. And I know that the big media conglomerates who actually have money to go to Washington and influence politicians, it's very easy for them to claim that that they're losing revenue because of people who are, quote, pirating their things. And that opens the how can I say, if as soon as you acknowledge the problem of piracy, it opens the gate, it opens the doorway to a whole bunch of problems. And I really appreciate it. I know that Stephen Kinsella was on Free Talk Live, like I think it was the day after I published that episode. And it's that's a point that he made, where if you think that intellectual property and copyright are problems, then you basically have a drug war situation where you're trying to stop people from doing something that they want to do, that where there's no real victim, as in I can share things with my friends and I'm not stealing anything from you, because there's no way to know that my friends would have bought the DVD or the game or the CD from you if I hadn't shared them with them. And just to make it an even more BS argument, if I share this with my friend, they might be so into it that they decide to buy it. And they wouldn't have had the option to do that had my DVD been unshareable for some reason, which is something that is often ignored when we talk about intellectual property.
So there does seem to be, within libertarian thought, there does seem to be a slight rift on this specific issue, more so than
right
on just about any other issue that I can think of anyway. And mm-hmm. Kinsella's position seems pretty clear-cut and pretty rational, that when somebody purchases something that becomes physical property, it's – and I've never talked about IP on my show. I actually did a series about IP with Wes Bertrand on his show, Complete Liberty. That was over a year ago. But
right.
Once you purchase a piece of physical property, how could we – be in favor of property rights, but also say that there should be some outside party after the point of that purchase that can dictate what can and can't be done with that property.
Exactly. The example that I use in my show was if you bought a physical painting from an artist, and at the point of sales, the artist says, if you duplicate this in any way and I find out, you're going to be in big trouble. That wouldn't make any sense. And it also implies that it's not a real sale, because even though you're exchanging money for this this thing, the person who sold it to you can still dictate what you're not allowed to do with it, and therefore what you are allowed to do with it. Therefore, it's not really yours.
Right. So, but this is, as far as SOPA is concerned, this is not even the merits of IP are not even something that's part of the debate. IP is as real to these legislators as actual property ownership, basically.
Yes.
Which is funny, yes, because that's not something that the legislators have shown on the federal level or on any level, really, to have a lot of respect for is personal property.
Yeah.
So it's
definitely.
It's interesting. It seems that through one means or another, the Internet for years now is something the government just wants to take back.
Of course.
You know, like one thing that people have always said to me when I talk about my positions as far as government is concerned is, well, you know, they gave us the Internet. That's one thing that people like to say. But it wasn't like, you know, a bunch of guys at the Defense Department were sitting around one day, and one of them kind of leaned forward and put his elbows on the table and his hands on his little cheeks and said, "Ooh, I feel like doing something creative today, guys."
Yeah.
You know, "Ooh, let's do something for the future." You know, I mean, this was...
Yeah, if there's one thing government likes to do, it's innovate.
Exactly. So ARPANET, which was basically the genesis of the internet, was the computer networking system that the Defense Department eventually contracted out, outsourced to have built, and that gradually evolved into the internet. But it seems like since I first heard about the internet in the early 90s, shortly after that, there was one scheme or another to bring it under control of the state. And I think before we were talking about SOPA, there was the big controversy was net neutrality.
Yeah. Yeah, absolutely. I'm not very well versed in net neutrality, but I know that it was under threat not too long ago. I think it was something about Google or something wanting to have a different service for cell phones or something like that, which would effectively have ended the net neutrality. But I don't have that much information on that issue.
More, I think I've forgotten most of what I knew about it as it kind of faded out of the spotlight. But SOPA does potentially offer the government a lot more, like a huge amount of control potentially over the internet. Am I correct?
Oh, absolutely. I mean, just the fact, well, as it was written, just the fact that a complaining party can have a site removed from the DNS service without any, like, before an investigation is even started is pretty alarming in itself. And before I forget to mention this, I know that the threat of SOPA is far from over, because I know that in Europe there's a similar law called ACTA that they are debating and discussing. And I also know that there's a similar law being discussed here in Canada. I think it's Bill C-11 or something like that, which would basically have the purported goal of protecting intellectual property, but basically has all the same problems that SOPA and PIPA had.
And when you're talking about a site getting pulled off the DNS based on a complaint, the complaint would have to be IP-related, I assume.
Yeah.
So where that threatens you and me too, especially
absolutely
my podcast, where I've used, you know, all of this music in the past, thinking like, I mean, I guess when I started, I was like, I'm not really trying to make a profit, and I really don't. I own this music anyway, so I'm going to use it if I want to use it, based on, you know, that was consistent with my idea about IP. If this all comes to fruition, this is like a real threat to a lot of creative people who produce media online. It's not, we're not just talking about gaming here.
Oh, absolutely. I mean, for me, I use the music from a different video game every episode. So this would absolutely affect me, even though I feel that I have a strong fair use claim. But ultimately, that's not up to me, because when someone brings something to court, then it becomes quite a hairy situation, because you have to be able to deal with that or to hire a lawyer, both of which are extremely difficult for someone who doesn't have the resources to do so or the know-how to do it on his own. Mm. Now, another thing that's interesting to ponder is how the whole blackout thing that happened on January 18th really had a strong effect on SOPA. I mean, I think the bill was effectively dead, quote unquote, within 2 days of that protest happening. And what was really interesting was that before that protest, there was actually a video released by the people at ScrewAttack.com basically proposing a boycott of E3, because the ESA, or the Entertainment Software Association, which basically lobbies for the game industry, they were in support of SOPA and PIPA. They, I think the number is $190,000 that they spent lobbying for SOPA and PIPA. And there were some a few game media creators that posted a video asking us to boycott E3, which is the biggest event of the ESA. And I actually got involved with that. I sent a few letters to some game review sites and things like that, asking them to support to ban E3 and not go there. And I find it was really a nice thing to see happen. I wish that I could have known how many other people participated in this, because effectively after Wednesday and the blackout, the support for SOPA basically plummeted to virtually zero. And on Friday, the chief sponsor of the bill said, we'll try to work a better solution, which is basically political speak for we'll come back with this later. And
yeah,
later
we'll
that
bury
day,
it somewhere
ESA,
else.
Yeah, exactly. And then they'll come up with the Super Good Times Free Speech Act, and which will be even worse.
Right.
But yeah. And another thing is that after that bill was dead, the ESA did pull their support for SOPA. But you can also see in their language that they use that. I mean, they're one of the big content creators, so they have a huge interest in treating IP as a real thing, and so. You could see in the language that they used that it was basically the same thing, like, we'll work a better solution. And so I wish I could have known how much of the ESA pulling its support was due to the letters that game reviewers and game creators and that kind of stuff got from their fans. But ultimately, the good news is that the bill is dead for now. But I hope that people don't fall into the trap of thinking that the story is over, because, as I mentioned, there are similar bills being discussed elsewhere in Canada and in Europe.
Right. And it does seem like the pushback has been significant, and that's good that people were aware of this, of course, considering that it affects the means by which or the channels by which most people get most of their information, or stands to affect those
exactly.
things. It was like pretty clear that this was not something that was going to be, you know, rammed through in the dark of night. So,
right.
Well, I certainly appreciate you filling us in on that, because that was something that, even though it potentially affects me, I had not done my homework on up to this point. And we've been at it for about an hour now, Sydney. So I was thinking we could wrap up, but I really appreciate you coming on. And, you know, this is all stuff that I've never dealt with on the show before. You want to just plug your stuff real quick?
Oh, yeah, sure. It's my site is gamingandliberty.com, and that's basically the best way to reach me. I have a contact form there. My email is syd@gamingandliberty.com, and from there you can find links to the podcast itself, the episode that I've published, and the Facebook page and the Twitter feed for those of you who would like to follow me via those means. And before I leave, it was a pleasure for me to be here, and I think that your show is one of the big steps that led me on the path that I'm on today, so I'm really overjoyed to have been here.
Oh, thank you very much. I really appreciate that. I'm glad I can do even partial contributions towards getting people to speak up and find their own voice and do their own thing. And certainly it was people like Stefan Molyneux and the Free Talk Live guys and Wes Bertrand that listening to them got me into the idea of doing this. And I have heard from a couple people that, you know, I listened to your show and I did this. And I just think that is the greatest thing. I'm very, very flattered when I hear that. So thank you very much. And do you have anything like for the future that you just want to, like what's coming up on your show?
One thing that I'd like to do is do game reviews, but do it from a libertarian perspective. But I still have a bit more groundwork to lay before I can get into that, especially considering how violent most video games tend to be. And I covered that in one of my episodes as well. But I just need to take it one step further. And once I do that, I'll be able to spend some time discussing the games of today and doing some kind of game review thing. And I really can't wait to get to Call of Duty, because I think that series has some very interesting things to discuss. As a matter of fact, today I watched a video, actually it was on ScrewAttack.com, where a guy was doing a quick rundown of the war crimes committed in Modern Warfare 3, which kind of scared me because I wanted to go in that direction as well. But having watched it, there's a lot of wiggle room for me to cover that topic. So I can't wait to get around to that.
Oh, I think that would be very interesting. You're talking about reviewing games from a Liberty perspective, I assume, right?
Yeah. I mean, it's done. I've seen it done for movies and books. So why not games? It's just another medium.
Absolutely. Yeah. Yeah. And yeah. It's certainly, you know, from what I've seen, I've watched like most recent video game that I've seen someone play was the Old Republic, and just the cinematic aspects of games like this today are absolutely amazing. It is like, it's like watching a movie that you are kind of participating in and directing.
Absolutely.
Or directing where it goes, I should say. So yeah.
Yeah, exactly.
Well, thank you so much for coming on the show, Sydney. Maybe this is something that we can do again in the future, and I wish you the best of luck going forward with gaming and Liberty.
All right. Thanks a lot, Brett. Anytime. It would be a pleasure to come back here.
And one more quick thing before we finish up for today. I want to play you a clip from a video podcast called Review Tech USA. The host goes through the history of the MPAA trying to use the government to control new technology that they saw as a threat to their industry. We heard that clip from the Max Kaiser show on RT, where he was talking about Jack Valenti and his comments about the VCR. So in this podcast, I'm going to pick up right after the host of the show quotes that statement from Jack Valenti, and this plays about 7 minutes. So I think this is a really important issue, and it certainly hasn't gone away, or it won't go away. It will spring up in some new form probably sooner than later. So if you want a little bit of context, I think this will be helpful. Like I said, it runs about 7 minutes. So take a listen. All right, bye.
Unfortunately, Jack was wrong about that. It was because of the VCR that the movie industry blew up in the 80s. Billions upon billions of dollars were made because of VCRs and movies being brought over the VHS. People wanted to watch the movies at home. The VCR was the best thing that could have ever happened to the movie industry. He was so wrong about it. But of course, the Motion Picture Association of America had to go down kicking and screaming, so they implemented something called Macrovision. What Macrovision was is that if you tried to record a pre-recorded VHS tape, say you got a movie from a store and brought it home and tried to make a copy of it, you couldn't because there was a signal on there that recognized if one VCR was connected to another, and it would scramble the video signal, so all you would have was a jumbled mess on the screen. But like any other attempt from the RIAA and MPAA to stop piracy, it was easy to get around. There were these simple little battery-powered boxes you could get that actually stripped the Macrovision signal from the VCR tape, so all you had to do was connect the video output signal of your VCR to this box, connect the output of the box to another VCR, and boom, there you go, you can make a copy of a tape. These boxes were readily available, affordable, and it totally debunked the whole concept of Macrovision. Way to go, MPAA! Now let's go back in history and talk about how the Recording Industry Association of America tried to squash a format because they feared piracy. That format was one that was created by Sony, and that was called DAT, which stood for Digital Audio Tape. What made the RIAA freak out about DAT is that it was a lossless digital recording format, meaning that it wasn't analog and there was no compression involved. So say you recorded one of your favorite CDs over to DAT, you could take that DAT tape and record it over and over again, and it will maintain the same audio integrity as the original master CD. It will never lose quality. And this made the music industry go insane. They threatened to sue any manufacturer that tried to bring DAT recorders into the country, and they wanted nothing to do with the digital audio tape format until Sony and Philips came out with the serial copy management system. SCMS copy protection looks for bits written in the subcode data in a digital link. There are three states of these bits. Copy allowed 00, copy wants 10, and copy prohibited 11. If the source has the copy bit 00 and a copy is made of the source, the copy itself will have the bit set at 00 as well, allowing copies to be made from the copies. If the source has the copy bit set as 10, every copy of this material will have the bit set to 11, and making a copy from the copy would be prohibited. Okay, so let me explain that again in English. If you didn't get it, don't feel bad, because that was really wordy. What happens is this. And this only counts for digital. If you record from a CD player to a DAT machine using analog cables, RCA cables, SCMS is null and void. It doesn't work that way. Say I have Nas's newest CD and I want to record that digitally using SPDIF, the CD, the master CD of Nas, would have the subcode 10 on it. Remember what that means? That means you can only record it once. Once I recorded it digitally over to the DAT tape, that would have the code on it 11. So say I try to go from that DAT tape to another DAT tape digitally, it wouldn't let me record it. It would actually say copy prohibited. I actually dealt with this before with SCMS. The screen would flash, would not let you record the tape. The whole thing that boggled my mind with the RIAA and SCMS, how bad they wanted SCMS implemented into DAT, is that you could just use the analog record inputs on a DAT machine and go from a CD player to the DAT machine analog, and there was no SCMS. There was no serial copy management system with that. So all you had to do was spend an extra 3 minutes to make sure you got the recording levels right, and it would sound virtually just as good as if you recorded the CD to the DAT digitally. And because you recorded the original DAT tape from the master analog and there was no SCMS, the code on the DAT tape would be 00. So you could daisy chain DAT machines together using SPDIF or digital coaxial and make 20 copies of that one DAT tape, and there wouldn't be any loss in quality, because remember, DAT does not compress the audio. So SCMS was a complete waste of time. There was no reason to do it, just like Macrovision with the VCR tapes. It was pointless. It just made a couple suits sleep better at night. It was ridiculous. It made me so angry. And then last but not least is the Recording Industry Association of America's lawsuit against Diamond for the Rio multimedia players back in 1998. The Recording Industry Association of America filed an application for a temporary restraining order to prevent the sale of the Rio player in the Central District Court of California, claiming the player violated the 1992 Audio Home Recording Act. Judge Andrea Collins issued the temporary order on October 16, 1998, but required the RIAA to post a $500,000 bond that would be used to compensate Diamond for damages incurred in the delay. Diamond then announced that it would temporarily delay the shipment of the Rio. On October 26, 1998, Judge Collins denied the RIAA's application. After the lawsuit ended, Diamond sold 200,000 players. Are you seeing the pattern here? Are you seeing that every time a new form of technology came out, that the RIAA and the MPAA and legacy media industries had to latch onto it and attack it and try to bring it down because they were afraid that it was going to cause them to lose money? It's just a pattern over and over again. And now the internet to the legacy media industries is like the new DAT player. It's like the new VCR. They don't understand it. They can't wrap their mind around it. So they have to attack it because they're afraid of losing money from it. Look, again, I'll end this video with this. I understand that piracy is a huge problem, okay? You could go to btjunkie.org right now and download any video game, any movie, any album that you want to in a period of minutes, literally 5 to 10 minutes. It's a huge problem. I get it. But what the movie industry and record industry doesn't get is that grow and evolve with the times. Don't try to stifle the innovation to make more money, because it doesn't work. Look at history. I just proved it to you with facts. Look at what Steve Jobs did with the MP3 technology. Instead of ignoring it and hoping that it goes away and just trying to stifle it when it becomes a problem, he embraced it. He created the iPod, he created iTunes, and now it's a multi-billion dollar industry. He realized where the tech was going. You guys, all you do when new tech comes out is try to fight it. And it never works. It always fails. The new technology, the evolution of technology, always prevails.
Everything is amazing right now, and nobody's happy.
They don't understand it. They can't wrap their mind around it, so they have to attack it.